Imagine walking into a massive conference room, right? And it's just filled with these highly paid legal and HR
Oh,
professionals.
yeah, the risk management crowd.
Exactly. These are people whose entire careers revolve around investigating workplace misconduct. And for decades, they have sat through, countless seminars.
All those mandatory compliance modules.
Right, the ones you just click through. But they read memos that drill this one specific undeniable fact into their heads, which is that victims of sexual abuse just do not follow a predictable behavioral script.
No, not at all. It's totally explicit in the training.
Yeah, they are taught over and over that trauma is incredibly messy.
It's actually a cornerstone of modern organizational psychology. Like anyone who goes through formal investigative certification learns very early on that there is no textbook way for a human being to respond to abuse.
But here is the fascinating and honestly terrifying paradox that we're jumping into on today's deep
The
dive.
disconnect.
Yeah, the disconnect. Because the moment a real flesh and blood victim walks into one of those HR offices and behaves in a way that's unexpected,
Like maybe they're incredibly angry
or they waited 6 months to report it, or they're still actively texting their abuser, those exact same highly trained experts tend to just like throw their entire training out the window.
right out the window. They revert straight back to their gut instincts.
It's wild. And we're using some incredible sources today to unpack this, primarily a very comprehensive 2026 paper by civil rights attorney Eric Sanders. It's called The Wrong Victim.
Such a great paper.
It really is. So our mission today for this deep dive is to figure out why victims often display behaviors that seem totally counterintuitive to the rest of us.
Right, the psychological mechanisms.
Exactly. We want to look at how institutions accidentally, or I guess sometimes intentionally, force victims into acting out, and how we just fundamentally misjudge credibility.
Yeah, by the time we wrap up this conversation, the way you view workplace dynamics and HR investigations, or even just arguments with your friends, is going to completely change.
I promise you that. So why does this happen? Why do experts forget everything they know?
Well, the persistence of this problem really comes down to human bias overriding established facts. I mean, Sanders points out that the legal and corporate worlds have had this data for a very long time.
Oh, yeah, decades, right?
Yeah, back in a 2007 study, Patricia Fanflick specifically warned prosecutors not to treat victim behavior as abnormal just because it, fails to fit public expectations.
And the DOJ has guidelines on this too, right?
They do. Fast forward to the 2024 Department of Justice guidance for prosecutors, and it explicitly states there is no typical demeanor for a victim.
None at all.
Right. I mean, sure, they might be visibly distraught, crying, but they might also be completely emotionally detached.
Just totally numb.
Exactly.
Oh,
Stoic.
yeah.
Or they might even be intensely angry or sarcastic.
Which, I mean, if you think about how a brain processes a threat, it makes total sense that someone might go numb or get super defensive.
Biologically, yes, it makes perfect sense.
But despite the DOJ handing prosecutors a literal manual saying that trauma looks different on everyone, institutions still expect victims to play this very specific, almost cinematic role.
Oh, the perfect passive victim.
Exactly. They want someone who's visibly distressed, but, remains completely polite, who instantly reports it to the proper channels and just immediately cuts all ties with the abuser.
Which is completely divorced from the reality of how human beings actually survive hostile
Yeah.
environments, especially when you factor in the physical location where the abuse happens.
At work.
Right, at work. If we pull back and look at the modern workplace, we really have to talk about hierarchy.
Okay, yeah, let's get into the hierarchy stuff.
So Sanders highlights this fascinating 2024 study by Hart and McLaughlin on hierarchical workplace relationships. And that study maps out how power imbalances fundamentally distort both consent and behavior.
Let's spend some time on the mechanics of that, actually, because it's one thing to talk about power dynamics in a textbook,
Sure.
but it's another thing entirely when a real person is just, trying to pay their rent and keep their health insurance.
Right, the real-world stakes. Take a subordinate experiencing unwanted sexual attention from a manager. That manager controls their schedule, their evaluations, their
Their
promotions.
whole livelihood, basically.
Exactly. So the subordinate's brain is just calculating survival. They might keep communicating cordially with that boss.
Send the emails with the smiley faces.
Yeah, sending the smiley faces. Or attending after-work social events just to preserve the appearance of total normalcy.
But to an outside observer, that looks like they're fine with it.
Right. To an investigator looking for a quick excuse to close a case, that cordial behavior looks exactly like consent.
Yeah.
But psychologically, it's actually the fawn trauma response.
Fawning. Right.
The employee fears that any open rejection is going to lead to them being quietly sidelined or just outright fired.
It's like being trapped in a maze, right? Where every single exit is booby-trapped.
That's a great analogy.
It's like playing a high-stakes game of poker, but the person sitting across the table holds the mortgage to your house.
And you can't leave the table.
Right. Even if you know they're cheating, you can't just flip the table and storm out because you'll lose everything. You just have to sit there and keep playing the game.
And the Hart and McLaughlin study points out a really striking detail about this dynamic. Women in these subordinate positions are placed in an absolutely impossible situation.
Completely impossible.
Because if you stay quiet and just try to survive the shift, the institution looks at your cordial emails and says, well, you must have consented.
Right.
But if you do pull the fire alarm and report the harassment, you walk into a completely different set of traps.
Because the fallout of reporting is like immediate, isn't it?
Immediate and highly social. The study found that women who report harassment are frequently negatively stereotyped by their own colleagues.
By their own peers. Wow.
Yeah, superiors and peers. The moment they speak up, they're suddenly labeled as less warm or viewed as attention-seeking.
Or they get framed as like a cutthroat employee trying to take down a boss just to advance their own career.
Exactly.
So you are basically penalized for silence, and you're penalized for speaking up. The status quo always protects itself.
Always.
So if playing the good, quiet victim fails, and speaking up politely gets you labeled as a troublemaker, what's the breaking point? Like, where does all that suppressed energy actually go?
Well, it has to go somewhere.
Right, because a lot of victims eventually realize the polite route is getting them nowhere, and they start getting really loud.
Which brings up a crucial psychological distinction that the legal system just really struggles to handle. The difference between internalized and externalized trauma responses.
Okay, break that down for us.
So historically, corporate institutions and courts are very comfortable with internalized responses. If a victim withdraws, cries, isolates themselves, shows visible fear.
That fits the script.
It fits the cultural script perfectly. We all know how to process a weeping victim.
It feeds right into that damsel in distress narrative. We are super comfortable playing the savior for someone who appears, you know, broken and helpless.
Yes, because it doesn't challenge the authority of the people in the room.
Oh, that's such a good point.
But trauma very often externalizes. So instead of sadness, it manifests as rage.
Like irritability or hostility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It looks like repeated aggressive complaints to HR or demanding that the abuser be fired or even public confrontations in the middle of the office.
And the moment that happens, the moment a victim externalizes their trauma and gets angry,
they stop looking like a victim.
Right. They stop looking like a victim to the institution and start looking like an administrative threat.
Which creates this incredibly cruel double bind. If you don't resist enough, if you just freeze or try to appease the abuser to survive the workday, the investigator says, well, your lack of resistance means it didn't happen.
But if you resist too much, if you send furious emails or demand accountability or threaten to go to the press,
then you're immediately labeled vindictive, unstable, or malicious.
It's like the acceptable window of victim behavior is narrowed down to almost zero.
Pretty much nothing. You have to be distressed, but you can't be too distressed.
Right.
You have to want accountability, but you can't seem too invested in actually punishing the person who hurt you, or else you look like you have an ulterior motive.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
Because I can hear someone listening to this deep dive right now, maybe someone who manages a big team, and they're thinking, okay, but if an employee is aggressively trying to ruin a coworker's life, and they seem purely motivated by revenge-like sending hostile emails at 2 a.m.
Sure, yeah.
Shouldn't an investigator view that as a massive red flag? Like, isn't it logical to assume that a highly vindictive person might just be making up a false accusation to get a rival fired?
And that is the exact trap investigators fall into. It is a completely understandable human impulse.
It makes sense on the surface.
It does. But Sanders introduces a core concept here to explain why that logic is structurally flawed. He calls it causal inversion.
Causal inversion.
Yes, and it's the central conceptual error in these investigations. An investigator absolutely should look at a punitive motive or a desire for revenge. Bias is always relevant.
Right.
But causal inversion happens when the institution takes the victim's hostility and uses it as definitive proof that the abuse never happened. They assume the hostility is what caused the allegation to be invented.
Ah, So they're mistaking the reaction for the motive.
Precisely.
It's like a doctor watching a patient have a massive violent coughing fit and assuming that the cough is what caused the cold.
That's exactly it.
Instead of taking a step back and realizing the cold is what caused the cough in the first place.
Right. The institution looks at the anger and concludes, you are a deeply angry, vindictive person. Therefore, you must be lying about this harassment just to hurt this employee. They completely fail to consider the alternative, which is usually the actual reality. You are angry and vindictive because you were abused and because no one in this building is listening to you.
They invert the cause and the effect.
Largely because judging an angry person is just so much easier than investigating a complex abuse claim against a powerful employee.
So how does this actually play out in the timeline of an investigation? Because if we understand that this explosive anger, the cough in our analogy, is a downstream reaction, we have to look at what they are reacting to.
Absolutely.
And according to the research in Sanders' paper, they aren't just reacting to the initial abuse anymore. They're actually reacting to the failure of the institution itself.
Yes. We have to trace the progression of how an outcry actually happens in the real world. Because a victim almost never starts by screaming in the company town square.
Right. Nobody starts at a 10.
No. The psychological progression usually begins with minimization. They try to ignore the harassment, just hoping it'll stop.
Hoping it'll go away.
When that fails, maybe they make a quiet, private disclosure to a trusted work friend. Then, if the behavior continues, they might file a formal, very polite HR complaint.
Following all the rules.
Following the rules. Mm-hmm. It is only when those formal, approved channels completely fail through administrative delays or outright disbelief, mm-hmm. or because the company is actively protecting a high-performing manager.
Which happens a lot.
A lot. It's only then that the victim escalates to externalized anger.
Because they realize the system isn't coming to save them, so they have to save themselves, and the tactics just get more extreme.
Exactly.
You know, I was reading through the notes on that study by Duffy, O'Shea, and Tang, and I got completely hung up on this one specific case study they featured. A woman identified as Ms. Zhu.
Oh, the Ms. Zhu case.
Yes. If you just look at the final chapter of her story, on paper, she seems totally out of control for a corporate environment.
She really does.
I mean, she's handing out leaflets, detailing an assault. She's mobilizing coworkers with an open letter. But what actually pushed her to that point?
Well, if you rewind the tape on Mrs. Zhu's case, her initial reaction was incredibly by the book.
Totally standard.
She reported a rape to management through the proper channels. And management essentially did nothing. They just sat on their hands.
That is just awful.
So facing a system that was completely ignoring a severe trauma, she escalated. The leaflets and the open letter that got all those signatures, those weren't her opening move. They were a last resort.
But through the rigid lens of a corporate HR department, she doesn't look like a victim anymore.
No. To HR, she looks like a rogue, disruptive employee. Mm-hmm. But Duffy and her co-authors analyze this specific escalation through the lens of institutional betrayal.
Institutional betrayal, that makes so much sense.
Because the institution's inaction fundamentally forced her to become disruptive. What looks like unhinged aggression to an executive is actually just desperate persistence in the face of a system actively trying to silence her.
And this is where the institutional feedback loop becomes truly toxic, right? Because once she starts handing out those leaflets and sending demanding emails, what does the institution do?
They pivot.
They completely stop looking at the original allegation.
Oh, absolutely. They open a disciplinary file on the victim.
They start investigating her for being difficult.
The focus shifts entirely to the victim's tone, her insubordination, or her, quote, harassment of the accused.
That is so dark.
The HR file just fills up with endless documentation about how disruptive she's become.
Mm-hmm.
And this creates a brilliant, albeit malicious, self-reinforcing narrative for the company.
How so?
Well, the institution creates an adversarial environment by ignoring her trauma. The victim reacts to that hostile environment by becoming hostile herself. And then the institution uses her hostility as concrete proof that she was an unreliable, unstable accuser all along.
It's gaslighting on an institutional scale.
It really is.
The original abuse allegation is just buried under a mountain of write-ups about the victim being unprofessional.
Yep.
Which leaves us with a pretty massive practical question here. If we cannot rely on a victim's post-abuse behavior to tell us if they're telling the truth, because trauma is messy and people get angry when they're ignored.
Right.
And if institutions are actively manufacturing the exact unstable behavior they then punish, how do investigators actually figure out the truth? because we obviously can't just blindly believe everyone who sends an angry email.
And Sanders is very clear about this distinction. Rejecting these outdated behavioral stereotypes does not mean abandoning rigorous credibility analysis.
Evidence still matters.
Evidence matters immensely. If a victim violates company policy, say they damage company property or stalk someone or leak confidential trade secrets, that is still actionable misconduct.
Being a victim doesn't give you a free pass.
Right. Being a victim of harassment does not grant you a blanket immunity from the rules of society or the workplace.
Yeah.
But the core argument is that we have to base our credibility analysis on objective evidence, not on whether the victim performed their trauma politely.
We have to value evidence over aesthetics.
Beautifully put.
So how does an investigator actually untangle the cough from the cold in practice? Like, how do they bypass their own cognitive bias when someone is literally screaming across the desk at them?
The solution lies in rigorous chronological context.
Chronological. Okay, timeline.
Exactly. Investigators have to build a timeline. They must separate pre-abuse behavior from post-abuse behavior.
Walk us through how that changes the perspective, because that seems huge.
It changes everything. If an investigator builds a timeline and finds that a supposed victim had a documented, highly hostile campaign against a coworker well before the alleged abuse ever happened.
Like they were already fighting.
Yeah, if they were already sending threatening emails, trying to get the person fired, or spreading rumors months in advance, that is a legitimate pre-existing motive to fabricate an allegation.
Right, because the hostility preceded the event. That's a huge red flag.
It's a massive red flag that requires scrutiny. But if the timeline shows that these two people had a normal, functioning, working relationship, then the alleged abuse happened, then the victim reported it, the institution delayed or ignored them, and only then did the hostility and the angry emails start.
Oh, okay.
That anger does not prove they are lying. In fact, it actually corroborates the sequence of events.
It backs up their story.
Yes. The hostility is a measurable consequence of the trauma and the institutional betrayal, not the cause of a false allegation.
This is such a massive aha moment. I mean, if you're an investigator or a manager or even just someone trying to mediate a dispute between two people on your team, the question you should be asking isn't, did this victim behave well?
No, not at all.
Or is this person acting the way I think a victim should act? The only question that matters is what happened and in what order.
That's the only thing that matters.
You have to factor power, financial dependency, and the failures of the institution itself into every single assessment of why someone made the choices they did.
And if we do not apply that temporal discipline, if we don't force ourselves to look at the timeline, we end up flattening the entire human experience.
We really do.
We end up comparing the victim's most dysregulated, traumatized, and frustrated moment against the abuser's most calm, controlled, and polished presentation in the HR office.
Oh, wow, yeah. Because the abuser isn't the one in crisis.
Right. And in any hierarchy, the more powerful person almost always has the advantage of appearing calm, having more resources, and speaking the language of institutional procedure.
Which means the system inevitably defaults to protecting the powerful simply because the powerful aren't the ones in distress.
Exactly.
Man, let's bring this all together. We started today by looking at how the workplace hierarchy traps victims in an impossible situation.
Right, the fear of retaliation.
Yeah, forcing them to maintain cordial relationships with their abusers just to survive the shift and keep their jobs.
And then we explored how causal inversion leads well-meaning investigators to just deeply misread a trauma response.
Seeing anger and misinterpreting it as evidence of vindictiveness and a pre-existing motive to lie.
Exactly.
And finally, we saw how institutional betrayal, the sheer friction of a system refusing to act, forces victims to scream just to be heard, only to be punished for being too loud. The solution isn't to judge the aesthetics of someone's outcry, but to rigorously examine the chronology of events.
Separate the cough from the cold.
Separating the cough from the cold. But I want to leave you with one final thing to mull over, and it builds on everything we've unpacked today in this deep dive.
Yeah, this is important.
The sources we reviewed emphasize over and over that even highly trained judges, seasoned prosecutors, and veteran HR lawyers consistently revert to these flawed behavioral stereotypes. Despite decades of specialized trauma training and mounds of data, they fall back on their own intuitive, lazy common sense.
It happens all the time.
So I want you to reflect on your own life. Think about the conflicts, the rumors, and the messy falling outs among your own friends, your family, or your coworkers. If legal experts whose literal job it is to understand trauma cannot outsmart their own cognitive biases.
Which they can't.
Right. How often are you relying on that same lazy common sense to judge the people around you? How often are you expecting the people in your life to follow a script that doesn't actually exist?
That's a tough question to ask yourself.
It really is. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives around you. And remember, just because the X-ray machine of human behavior doesn't show a clean break, doesn't mean the bone isn't shattered. Take care, everyone.